Hello, and welcome to the Bookshelf Conversation, the podcast segment of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with authors, artists, musicians, filmmakers, anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture, because that's our slogan. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. They say the golden age of a thing, in this case a sports thing, is often what you remember from your childhood, a time when you had a love for the game that wasn't affected by too much grown-up knowledge of salary disputes, gossip, scandal, etc. Roger Kahn got the ball rolling with the Boys of Summer, a nostalgic look at the Brooklyn Dodgers of the late 1940s to early 50s, which became a classic in the genre of baseball literature, perfect for the boomer generation. Even if you weren't a baseball fan, the Dodgers were a cultural institution. How many World War II movies included some wounded freckle-faced soldier who, with his dying breath, wanted to know how the bums were doing? But the baby boomers have been replaced in the nostalgia marketplace. Now it belongs to those who grew up in the late 60s to mid-70s who are getting the attention, covered by authors like Dan Epstein and Jason Turbo. Michael Leahy's The Last Innocence, the collision of the turbulent 60s and the Los Angeles Dodgers, has become one of my favorite books, not just about baseball, but in general. Add Sridhar Papu to that growing list of writers who cover the social commentary slash baseball challenge in The Year of the Pitcher, Bob Gibson, Denny McLean, and The End of Baseball's Golden Age, published late last year. Still trying to catch up, sorry. Not only does this work look at the unique 1968 season, in which McLean won 31 games while Gibson dominated in the National League, but also the larger issues of that year, especially in terms of civil and racial unrest in America. Here's my interview with Sridhar Papu, recorded last October. Sridhar Papu, welcome to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So what was so fascinating to you about this particular topic? Because I'm guessing you weren't around in 1968.
No. I mean, I'm a student of American history, and obviously, you know, that particular year was probably the most tumultuous of our time with the assassinations of Kennedy and Martin Luther King and race riots across the country and, you know, the rise of the Democratic National Convention. And then, you know, as a baseball fan, I don't know about you, but I sort of feel like you sort of learn the history of the game almost through osmosis. And so when it came time to sort of think about what I wanted to write about and if it was going to be a baseball book, this just naturally sort of came to my head.
Now, the 1960s seems to be a new golden age of books about baseball in that area. Do you think that's a byproduct of an aging readership? I mean, this seems to be the latter stage of the boomer generation.
I can't really answer that, but maybe. but also, I think that, I mean, if you think about it in terms of reporting-wise, you know, most of the people I'm interviewing or I interviewed for the book are now in their 70s, and, you know, and you know, over the course of reporting, you know, a couple passed away. So, I mean, this is your last chance to really sort of talk to these people. So, you know, I think it's a combination of probably an older readership looking back at their youth and really sort of having one last shot, if you will, to talk to the people that were involved during that time.
Well, the reason I brought up that question is, I don't know if you're familiar with Michael Leahy's book, The Last Innocence. I thought that was an excellent book, and it also covers what was going on in America and this a little bit earlier, in the early to mid-1960s. And there have been several books about baseball in the early 1970s as well. So I'm just wondering, that nostalgia seems to become more recent as time goes by.
Yeah, and, you know, I think you were right in terms of that readership, because, I mean, this is what they remember, right? You know, as teenagers, as young people. And so, you know, you find yourself wanting to go back and relive it or learn things that you know, didn't know before.
Have you heard anything from readers? Do they contact you at all?
From reviewers and from peers and from, you know, some readers. And, you know, the general sentiment has been positive. you know, one of the things I tried to sort of not be in this book was nostalgic. I mean, number one, you know, I wasn't alive then. But I think sometimes baseball and baseball books fall prey to sort of leaning on nostalgia to carry the book through. And so, you know, I try to really use a reporter's lens through it and you know, sort of try and take either myths apart or sort of things that we sort of take for we've always sort of taken for granted apart, you know, just by sheer reporting. You know, one of the things that sort of pops up when you talk about the 68 Tigers in particular is this idea that somehow that the Tigers of that year reunited the city of Detroit following the 1967 riots. And it takes about 5 minutes of reporting to show that's not true. And, you know, you want it to be true. I mean, but, you know, these are complicated issues of race and poverty and all sorts of things. And, you know, they're not solved by a terrific baseball team and a great season.
See, now, a generation earlier, if you're talking about the Brooklyn Dodgers, that was a team that seemed to bring a very diverse city together. No matter what was going on, people seemed to have a collective joy in rooting for the Dodgers. But as you say, you know, by the 1960s, things were kind of falling apart in the inner cities, and baseball wasn't that glue that was able to hold things together. The book concentrates mostly on Bob Gibson and Denny McClain. Could you talk about the contrast between these two pitchers?
Well, I don't think you could find two more different people, and personality-wise, than Gibson and McClain. And, you know, it's interesting though, when in researching Gibson, you know, everyone sort of, even then, sort of viewed him as the sort of figure of the Black Power movement, of which he wanted nothing to do with. And I sort of view him as sort of almost a pitching version of, you know, Ted Williams or Joe DiMaggio, who, you know, went to the ballpark and, you know, did his job, did it very well, and, you know, didn't have much use for either the press or for fans. And, you know, it could be difficult when placed in situations outside the park. And then here you have Denny, who is the consummate showman and, you know, is really sort of set apart from his team. I mean, one of the interesting things that sort of came across in the book is that, you know, how great a teammate that Gibson was, and people considered him. You know, we think of him as a sort of a lone wolf, and, you know, because he didn't talk to players from other teams, but he was great with his own teammates. You know, contrast with Denny, who, you know, was really apart from the rest of his team and was the consummate, like I said, showman, and, you know, and almost saw the future in a way. He saw baseball as a vehicle for building his brand and for developing something outside the game, but he saw it as a way of playing the organ and building a career playing the organ, and this is 1968. So, you know, he's almost there, but not quite.
Well, was McClain actually that skilled in the organ? Was he that good a musician?
You know, from the time, I mean, you know, from the time he was, you know, very young, his father, who passed away in his teens, who could be quite mean, made sure that he played the piano and played, practiced the organ and played, practiced baseball. And you know, I've avoided, I mean, he actually had an album that was, that I think, believe Columbia Records put out. I haven't listened to it. It's not my thing, but you can actually look on YouTube and find a clip of him playing on the Ed Sullivan Show, and he seems pretty accomplished. So
I'm more interested in finding a clip of Bob Gibson on Gentle Ben.
I was actually able to find that. I mean, there were two instances that came up. One was I saw a little notice of the opening of the book takes place in the Bob Hope Show, and there's someone in England who has DVDs of every single Bob Hope special ever made, and then I saw a little notice that, you know, following the 1967 series, the endorsements that Gibson thought he was due and sort of the public appearances and that stuff, you know, started to come in a little bit, and one of them was an appearance on Gentle Ben, in which he plays himself, but not really, and I was able to find someone who, again, had collected all the Gentle Ben episodes. from that period. So, and watching Gibson ask a young, I think Bruce Howard, who's Ron Howard's brother, you know, what's a brushback pitch? And so it's not a great moment in television history, but it's amusing.
Now, could you just, I'm sure the vast majority of people who are listening to this don't know what the Gentle Ben TV show was about.
So from my understanding, and I've only watched a couple episodes because actually Bart Starr is in the next one, it's Dennis Weaver and his son living in the Florida Everglades, and then they have a bear that's kind of their pet, who they call Ben. am I going to answer
like, television also.
Yes. I kind of view that as sort of the last vestiges of television, you know, before the 1970s explosion of, you know, when, you know, pioneers like Norman Lear and Lorne Michaels changed the game, because I don't want to say it's unwatchable, but it was of its time.
No, certainly, yeah, it certainly doesn't hold up after all these years. What about the research? Again, since you weren't around at the time, I had to do a lot of research for this. What surprised you the most?
I guess, well, I don't know. I was surprised about, you know, I went in believing certain things, and one of them was, you know, as I mentioned, 1968 being a tumultuous time, but, you know, also we have to remember it was a highly politicized time for sports in America. And I was expecting to find that in baseball, that theme running in baseball as well. And then I didn't. And so, you know, I spent a fair amount of time trying to understand why baseball didn't have the kind of political flavor to it that, you know, say the Olympic boycott movement had, or, you know, didn't have a figure like Bill Russell or Jim Brown. And so so that surprised me, you know, initially. And then you come across other things in terms of, you know, how many innings that Denny McClain actually pitched that year, because I think people sort of view him as lucky and all that kind of stuff. But, I mean, he was really a workhorse, you know, that season for that team, and, you know, pitching on 2 days rest and so on. And you know, it was stuff like that that I just found really, really interesting. And you know, it just takes legwork, and you know, talking to as many people as possible, and reading as much as possible, and you know, going blind reading microfiche. So.
One of the things I find fascinating about that era, and a lot of modern day fans can't fathom this, but you have Bob Gibson throws 28 complete games out of 35 starts. 28 complete games is probably the total of a whole league at this point. And then here you have pitchers who are throwing 265, 270, 300 innings. And it's unfathomable these days with all the modern technology and all the training techniques. Pitchers seem to break down more now than they did in those days. But that's a discussion for another time, another book. What was the most difficult part of doing this book for you?
Well, I mean, you know, Bob Gibson didn't speak to me, or at least until the very, very end, when we have the epilogue, we have a encounter. But so, you know, when anytime, you know, you don't get cooperation, you have to build a narrative around them. So that meant talking to both his ghostwriters and even going back to his really good friend Rodney Weed, who he came up with in the neighborhoods of North Omaha, and then finding guys like Bill Fitch, who basketball fans will remember, you know, was the coach of the Celtics and many other teams, who just happened to be his baseball coach at Creighton. And so, you know, that was particularly difficult. And then the other thing is, you know, finding people who. And again, we're talking about men who are entering their 70s and possibly 80s. You know, people who can remember these events, and even if they're pivotal events in their lives, you know, asking them to remember very, very specific details about, you know, what a pitcher was doing at a particular moment, what. You know, what was said, you know, you have to sort of forgive time if things aren't exactly what you want them to be.
Now, this is a problem when you do talk to people of a certain age, and even of younger age. It's a combination of either they aren't remembering it correctly or they're conflating things a little bit. How do you decide?
Well, I mean, thankfully you have secondary sources. So when someone says, when someone, you know, makes a comment, you know, you're able to look at the Detroit Free Press or the St. Louis Post-Dispatch or the New York Times or, you know, various other accounts so that, I mean, you know, there's almost 75 pages of endnotes in this book. And so what every sentence that I wrote, I wanted to make sure that I had it correctly. And so, you know, you cobble together, you look at, also you have to understand who the narrator is. So, you know, occasionally if someone's in a not that great of a state memory-wise and remembers something in a certain way, and then you talk to someone else who remembers things, you know, very vividly, and you can back it up, I think you're able to you know, present the account accurately.
Now, there are two people who you spent a lot of time on in the book, and I'd like you to explain a bit why. One is the pitching coach, the great pitching coach, Johnny Sain, and the other is Jackie Robinson, who was on his way out, basically, by that point, and he wasn't really a major figure as far as baseball memory goes. Of course, in the grand scale of things, yes, but talk about why you decided that they needed to be a part of this book.
Well, in terms of Sain, he came up early in my research. He was Danny McClain's pitching coach in 1968, and he just started fascinating me. And I just, as I went back, I don't think you can write about the golden age of pitching without talking about Sain, who, you know, I'll make the argument that he was the greatest pitching coach not only of that era but of all time, and how he developed his ideologies. You know, how he became, you know, this guy who was a very good pitcher with the Boston Braves along with Warren Spahn to someone who teams would count on and bring in time and time again, beginning with the New York Yankees where he worked with guys like Ralph Terry and Jim Bowden and Whitey Ford, and then going to the Twins where he helped Mudcat Grant and Jim Cott, and then comes to the Tigers who had been a very talented team but and with a really talented pitching staff but just couldn't get there. And then you have a guy like Sain who was able to look at these personalities like McClain and his teammate Mickey Lolich, you know, who neither of whom could stand each other and were, you know, perhaps difficult to deal with in their own ways. But, you know, he was able to harness the best efforts out of them. And so he was just endlessly fascinating in terms of, you know, here's a man who, you know, didn't go to college, but you know, went to flight school with, you know, Ted Williams and Johnny Pesky and became very interested in aerodynamics, but also became very interested in understanding the mind of a pitcher and what someone needed to do, and, you know, would give out motivational books, but also would, you know, never went out to the mound. He would talk to them the day after. He treated each person as an individual, and so that's what made him completely fascinating to me. And I don't think the Tigers would have won the World Series, quite frankly, had they not had him as their coach. And then you have Robinson, who actually Sain through his was the very first pitcher that Robinson ever faced. And I had been doing some general 1968 research. And there's a small line about him having lunch with Hubert Humphrey the day of the Chicago riots during the convention. And so then it just sort of interested me that in terms of his involvement in sort of the greater social causes. And so I spent a lot of time in the book about talking about his post-baseball life, because what happened by 1968 is he's very much a man in exile, you know, from the game that made him a star. And yet, we always think about Jackie Robinson in politics when it comes to, you know, endorsement that, you know, he ended up regretting of Richard Nixon in 1960. But, I mean, here's a man who throughout the decade, you know, time and time again when called on to speak on issues of integration and civil rights, was there. And so by 1968, his health is abysmal, and his family life is falling apart. And yet, time and time again, he is called back into the fray, and being the fighter that he was, you know, answers that bell. And he's really my sort of link to from baseball to what was going on that year. Because, I mean, if you're looking for someone who was the real connection, it's a man who was estranged from the game, and I thought that was fascinating.
Well, certainly for me, this is quite nostalgic. 1968 was right in the wheelhouse of my golden era, you know, which I always define as when you're young enough and innocent enough to think you play the game for nothing if you had the opportunity. And certainly after that, things changed dramatically. You had divisional play and expansion the next year, and a lot of people say that that's what certainly people of a certain age would say that that's what ruined the game, is that you no longer have the best team in each league playing each other now, thanks to, or not thanks to, the series of playoffs. But finally, I just wanted to ask you about the making of The Sausage. How did you go about finding a publisher for this book?
So, almost kind of the typical way of that most nonfiction authors do. My agent and I had a long discussion about the kind of book I wanted to write. I wrote a proposal based on, you know, just sort of cursory research, and then ended up finding a great publisher in Houghton Mifflin and a great editor, Susan Canavan, and who not only believed in the book but had tremendous patience, because this took a number of years, far longer than I ever anticipated.
How many years?
I didn't want to say six in total.
Wow. And obviously you're working on other things at the same time, so how do you find the ability to split between your day job as a journalist and working on the book?
It's tremendously hard, and I will say that, like, there were periods when I was working exclusively on the book, just because you do need focus and you do need concentration. I'm not a guy who either works well or writes well at late at night. So so that meant some early morning hours and going through the day like that. So and, you know, ruining your weekends for forever. my friend, the late David Carr's wife, when he was writing his extraordinary memoir, referred to his book as the bookstress, because he was spending all the time working on that. And so I think anyone who engages in this kind of thing, you know, you end up devoting so much of your life to it, while other things end up taking a back seat, unfortunately.
Now, you credit your editor. Was your editor savvy in all aspects of the book? Because I know some might be stronger in the political aspects versus the sporting items.
Well, Susan built the sports imprint of Muhammad Ali, and is actually the editor of John Ige's great... built the sports imprint at Houghton Mifflin, and is the editor of John Ige's terrific new Muhammad Ali biography. So, I mean, I guess in terms of, she knows the game, and it was really important to have an editor who not only liked you as a writer and reporter, and you could help you along, but also, you know, knows baseball.
Sure.
And you know, when I went a little too far afield, you know, I mean, in particular with Robinson, just because I enjoyed writing about him so much, she would say, you know, pull back on this, you know. This is important, but these are things you're going to lose focus if you concentrate on that.
Well, the book is The Year of the Pitcher, Bob Gibson, Denny McLain, and the End of Baseball's Olden Age, and we've been talking with its author, Sridhar Prabhu. Sridhar, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And that was the Bookshelf Conversation with Sridhar Prabhu. Check in again soon. Check out the website, Ron Kaplan's baseballbookshelf.com, for news about our next guest on the Bookshelf Conversation. Hopefully by that time I will have gotten rid of this nasty cold, which may make my voice sound better, who knows. In any case, if you have any questions or comments, please email me at ronkaplansbaseballbookshelf@gmail.com. And remember to check the website frequently for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews. Until then, this is Ron Kaplan saying so long, everybody.
Dead boys, I'm glad I discovered this land.